This is going to be a session that is basically on mothers and daughters, and of course, by extension, family kinds of issues. But the vehicle for getting at those issues is my favorite, which is short stories and poetry, because I love those things, and I find that they teach me and give me insights. And I think probably that's true of you. I wish I could give each of you a copy of each thing we're going to look at. There are a couple copies here, and there are a few out around, so if you want to find a passage, look for someone who's got one of these Xerox copies and find a passage and read it to us. The two short stories are Alice Walker's Everyday Use for Grandmama and Tilly Olson's story, I Stand Here Ironing. The model for the evening in terms of the dynamics of it is that I want your participation, but I can't, what I often do is lecture or talk for half an hour and then have a half an hour discussion. And I don't think that'll work in this because of the length of the stories and the amount of stuff in them. So what I would like is to have constant flow back and forth. I'd like you to interrupt, make points, add on, tell your own story throughout. And if we can get many people participating, I think that would be a good thing. We're all parts of families. We've all been, all the women here have either been mothers or daughters or both, and you have a wealth of expertise, and you also have a wealth of anguish about your role as a daughter or as a mother in most, I would venture to say most cases, if you were asked that kind of a question that would bring those memories to the fore. There's someone here this coming week who's going to be dealing with our memories of family, and I think that's a wonderful idea. And then those of you who are men, of course, are our sons and fathers, and it's a similar kind of dynamic. So I think we're all experts, and I think I'll just charge into some of this material that I'd sort of formed in my mind, and then we can get into some good discussion. I wanted to read you a poem by Alice Walker, who's the author of one of these stories, a short poem, explaining, in a sense, why our personal experience is the stuff of life and is political. There's an old women's movement phrase called the personal is political. And I think it's borne out in a million ways. The personal has to have ramifications into our lives in larger ways than just personal. This poem is called Women of Color Have Rarely Had the Opportunity to Write About Their Love Affairs. And it's a quote out of a review of a book in the New York Review of Books. The entire poem is a quote out of this review in the New York Review of Books. Alice Walker found it. She's calling it a found poem because she read it there and it, to her, became a poem. Since he had few intimate friends and little is known about his private life, it is of interest that Shirley Graham, his second wife, has now published an account of their life together in His Truth is Marching On. Unfortunately, however, her version of Du Bois' career is perhaps more revealing of herself than of her late husband. The gaps in Mrs. Du Bois' memoir are more instructive than her recollections. She has nothing to say about the internal drama of the NAACP's birth. She mentions Du Bois' conflict with Washington only in passing, and his debates with Garvey, not at all. Instead, she clutters her narrative with lengthy accounts of her father's work in the NAACP, the food Du Bois liked, and the international celebrities she was able to meet because she was married to Du Bois. Women of color have rarely had the opportunity to write about their love affairs. There are no black legends comparable to that of Heloise and Abelard, or even of Bonnie and Clyde. Mrs. Du Bois, who was known as a writer before she married, seems to have wanted to fill this gap. Her recollections, unfortunately, are a cloying intrusion into any serious effort to understand Du Bois. She assumes her romance with Du Bois to be as interesting as any other aspect of his career. It's sort of dripping with condescension, and makes the point that the personal is not political in some people's eyes, and that they would prefer not to have to think about the importance of people's lives. But that's not what we're going to do tonight. These two stories, which I got both out of this book, Women in Fiction, which I enjoy a lot, are both about mothers and daughters. In that both stories, the person telling the story is the mother in the first person, and her point of view dominates the story in both cases. She is, in both cases, I think it's fair to say, wise, very wise. She sees into the heart of her daughters, she sees into her own heart, and she understands much about the world around them. So there are some things that these really have in common. I would say that in Walker's story, the mother changes. In the end, she's a changed person, that something happens in that story that changes her. And it changes her relationship with her daughter. I don't think that's true in Tilly Olson's story. I think in Tilly Olson's story, she struggles and goes through pain. She's ironing the whole time she's telling the story. And her image at the end is that she has worked over the material of the story about her daughter the same way as she worked over the dress she was ironing, just sort of back and forth and back and forth and worrying it to death, but not getting anywhere. So in the end, what she does is summarize, literally. She summarizes her story in the second to the last paragraph. So she doesn't change. She may come to more acceptance or resignation of what has happened to her daughter and to herself. Both stories have a litany of sorrows. Both of those women suffered, and they suffered because of their daughters. They suffered seeing the pain that their daughters went through in their daughters' lives. Gave the women themselves their own pain in their lives. And they explain that pain in the story. The story is a vehicle for expressing that. And I suspect that most of us have similar kinds of stories we can tell, either as daughters or as mothers. It's interesting that the point of view here as the mother lets us see very little how the daughter would have told the story. It would be fascinating to have the same story, the same author write the same story from the daughter's point of view. They both start out, the first word in both of them is I, and it's, I will wait for her in the yard that my other daughter and I cleaned and prepared and fussed over yesterday is one of them. I stand here ironing as the other one. They're both very commonplace chores that they're doing, and they start out talking about the woman's work is never done. It's this kind of part of their life and part of the stuff they express in their poetry and in their wisdom is tied intimately to the details of daily life, which I think is something women are good at. I even made, as I was taking notes on the two stories this morning, I thought about time and past, present, and future because it was mentioned regularly throughout both stories. It is that's an excellent point. And then the final point I want to say is that in the sense that the personal is political, the political points made by these stories are substantial, I think. They are both stories exist and stand as a criticism of something outside of that family. It criticizes a society. Both families are poor, and the poverty extracts a terrible price from them. In the Walker story, just the poverty, the three-room house that they live in with no proper windows, and with they love their house and they love their yard. But it does seem kind of stark. But the real price they paid, I think, was not being in a society that had a fire service, for one thing. There was a terrible fire, the house burned down, and the child was badly damaged in the fire. And there was no sense of a civic support system to have helped them in that circumstance. And then the other damage that's done to the family is done by sending one daughter off to college. There's some kind of a price that is extracted from the family by the distance that child moves from them through her experience of leaving home. And the in Tilly Olson's story, the poverty, I mean, the litany of sorrows there is literally paragraph by paragraph a sorrow is mentioned and explained, and each one is an incredibly painful thing. And many of them are related to the fact that she was abandoned by her husband when her child was 8 months old, and because he said he couldn't stand living with them in want or in need, in poverty. The poor man. So he left. And then she had to go to work, she had to put the child in poor child care, she had to do, you know, many, for the next 5 years in particular, just the price that burden on her extracted was very significant. I'm going to start with Alice Walker's story, Everyday Use, and just highlight some things. But first, before I do that, I wonder if there are more comments that people have, or questions, or feedback. Okay, let's just plunge into it. How many of you, just out of curiosity, have had a chance to read it? Quite a few of you have. That's nice. I think that'll help you and me. The story is a story, I'm going to read you the first two paragraphs to set the stage, because I think they're telling. I will wait for her in the yard that Maggie and I made so clean and wavy yesterday afternoon. Maggie's her daughter. She has two daughters. The I is the mother. A yard like this is more comfortable than most people know. It is not just a yard. It is like an extended living room. When the hard clay is swept clean as a floor and the fine sand around the edges lined with tiny irregular grooves, a decoration around the edge. Have you seen that? Japanese gardens have it, and lots of, well, homes like this sometimes do, I guess. And it's a lovely, I've just seen it lately quite a few places. If you start noticing those wavy lines in sand or in fine dust, really pretty. When the fine sand around the edge is lined with tiny irregular grooves, anyone can come and sit and look up into the elm tree and wait for the breezes that never come inside the house. And she says anyone can come and sit. And since she's standing there waiting for her other daughter in that yard, you assume that the other daughter is part of anyone that can come and sit and enjoy this yard and feel the breezes. Maggie, the first daughter, will be nervous until after her sister goes. She will stand hopelessly in corners, homely and ashamed of the burn scars down her arms and legs, eyeing her sister with a mixture of envy and awe. She thinks her sister has held life always in the palm of one hand, that no is a word the world never learned to say to her. Now, we learn later in the story that the privileged sister, or the sister called Dee, who is the one that's coming, the anticipated one, in fact has had no said to her many times and has not had that wonderful a life. But that's the framework that the mother is setting up now. Then she changes her pace. Alice Walker changes her pace. She's such a fabulous writer. It's so much fun to just watch the craft of the writer. The first two paragraphs were the ones I just read you, were from the personal point of view, this mother standing awaiting her child. The next five paragraphs are even physically set off, extra spaces around them to separate them from the rest of the story. And it talks about her frame of mind. It kind of gets into her mind wandering, and it talks about shows on TV where you've seen shows, she says, where the child who has made it is confronted as a surprise by her own mother and father, tottering weakly in from backstage. And she talks about how the children, the child and the parents should like each other and be glad to see each other. But then she thinks, well, what if they don't? And they start screaming at each other on TV and hate each other. And then she says, well, she has that dream that she and her daughter Dee, the anticipated child, would have that experience. And Dee would pin an orchid on her. Although, she says, Dee always thought orchids were tacky and she hated them. And then she says, and I would be 100 pounds lighter, and my skin would be an uncooked barley pancake, smooth and light and beautiful, in her notion of how this televised thing would be, you know, this ideal mother and child. And then she concludes this little set-off part by saying, but that is a mistake. I know even before I wake up, because it's a dream. Whoever knew a Johnson with a quick tongue? Who can even imagine me looking a strange white man in the eye? It seems to me I have talked to them always with one foot raised in flight to white men, with my head turned in whichever way is farthest from them. Dee, though, she would always look anyone in the eye. Hesitation was no part of her nature. So the mother has really set up a situation here where there's the shy daughter with the burns who's going to stand and look ugly and be uncomfortable as long as Dee was there. And then Dee, who looks the world in the eye and is really together. And then we go back to the narrative of what's happening. Maggie, the shy daughter, comes out. How do I look? And Mama notices that she looks thin and kind of ragged. But she describes her beautifully. It's really poetic, her language. And she refers then to the fire that burned their other house to the ground. And how awful, especially Maggie's eyes were in the fire. And then she says that Dee's eyes were, Dee was dancing, almost dancing around the ashes because she hated the house so much. So their reactions to the fire was that Maggie got badly burned, and Dee was delighted that the house was gone. We're not liking Dee much by now. She's pretty much making us not like Dee. She says, Dee, I used to think that she hated Maggie too, but that was before we raised the money, the church and me, to send her to Augusta to school. She used to read to us without pity. So Dee would read to Maggie, the mother. Forcing words, lies, other folks' habits, whole lives upon us too, sitting trapped and ignorant underneath her voice. She washed us in a river of make-believe, burned us with a lot of knowledge which we didn't necessarily need to know, pressed us to her with a serious way, she read, to shove us away just at the moment, like dimwits we seemed about to understand. This mother's really struggling with how she's going to welcome Dee, her daughter, home. And then she goes into another one of these set-off parts and talks about her own history. I never had an education. When I was a kid, they closed our school when I was in second grade, and she says, in 1927, colored asked fewer questions than they do now. So she felt like that was just the way she'd come into this life, and it was her timing, and that was the consequences of her timing. And then she has Maggie reading to her, again, back in time, the history. Sometimes Maggie reads to me. She stumbles along good-naturedly, but can't see well. She knows she is not bright. Like good looks and money, quickness passed her by. And she talks about her own weaknesses, and she's not a good singer, but she likes to sing, and just sort of dreaming again about her past. And then, just as she's about to, then the last part of that dream, I'm sorry, in the set-aside part again, the last part of the dream is remembering Dee's rough times in her past, how she didn't have friends, and she couldn't make friends, and she wouldn't bring friends home because she was ashamed of her home. And she had liked a man or a boy who had found her too nagging and critical and had fled in the other direction. Just in the middle of that reverie, Dee arrives. And Maggie attempts to make a dash for the house to hide, and the mother forces Maggie to stay there. And then it's a sentence that I find so intriguing. The car stops in front of the house. She says, "It is hard to see them clearly through the strong sun." And I love that sentence, and I'm attracted to the image, but I can't think what it means. I mean, I can't figure out the dynamics of that. Does anybody have an idea? It's hard to see them clearly through the strong sun. They've been sitting out in the sun in this nice yard for a long time waiting, and now they're here and she can't see them through the strong sun. But even the first glimpse of leg out the car tells me it is Dee. Her feet were always neat looking, as if God himself had shaped them with a certain style. So then she gets out of the car and she does bring a friend home, a man. And later in the story she says, she never did tell me if she was married to that man. But the man is very strange looking, and her attention is drawn to him. And he, hair all over his head, a foot long, and hanging from his chin like a kinky mule tail. I hear Maggie suck in her breath. Is what it sounds like. And so they're, and then Dee gets out, and Dee comes close to them, and before Dee gets to them, she turns and runs back to the car and gets out a Polaroid camera and takes a whole series of photographs of the two, of her mother and sister, every single photograph, including the house, the three-room house with the no windows. So she doesn't hug them, she doesn't touch them, nothing. She starts toward them, and they're gasping because both Dee and this man look quite odd to them. And both Dee and the man say something African to them, which they can't understand and don't understand where it's coming from. And then Dee runs back to the car and gets out a camera and starts taking pictures of her. And she's just sort of, and Maggie, the other daughter, is just periodically gasping and totally blown away.
And Dee is black, is this man white?
No, he's black.
And he has a long beard.
That's what it says, like a mule tail. Short, stocky fellow with his hair to his navel is all grinning as he follows up with, "Assalamu alaikum, my mother and sister." He moves to hug Maggie, but she falls back, right back up against the back of my chair. I feel her trembling there, and when I look up, I see the perspiration falling off her chin. And then's this camera business, taking photographs, and it's related to the seeing, I think, but whether or not they can see each other and what they can see. Meanwhile, Assalamu, whatever. Is going through the motions with Maggie's hand. Maggie's hand is as limp as a fish and probably as cold despite the sweat, and she keeps trying to pull it back. It looks like Assalamu alaikum wants to shake hands but wants to do it fancy. Or maybe he don't know how people shake hands. Anyhow, he soon gives up on Maggie. So the mother is just sort of matter of fact. This is not going to go. Then she says, "Well," I say, "Dee." And Dee says, "No, Mama, not Dee." And then she tells her African name. And the mother says, "What happened to Dee?" "She's dead," Wangaroo said. "I couldn't bear it anymore, any longer being named after the people who oppressed me." "You know as well as me you was named after your Aunt Dicey," I said. "Dicey's my sister. She named Dee. We called her Big Dee after Dee was born." "But who was she named after?" asks Wangaroo. "I guess after Grandma Dee," I said. "And who was she named after?" asks Wangaroo. "Her mother," I said, and saw Wangaroo was getting tired. "That's about as far back as I can trace it," I said, "though in fact, I probably could have carried it back beyond the Civil War through the branches." So this was a real family name. And her daughter, she had given it to her daughter Dee. And later there's a sort of thing about Maggie was the family person and possibly should have had the family name. But then Dee says, "Well, all right, call me Dee." And the mother says, "No, I'll learn your new name. Teach it to me. Run it past me a couple more times. I'll get with it. It's all right. If you want to be called that name, I'll call you that name." So the mother is very quick to get with it. She's not caught up in the past, and she says, that's fine. Why shouldn't I? I asked. If that's what you want us to call you, we'll call you. So that's what they settle on. I'm going to just summarize a couple of things that happen. They go in the house and they start to have dinner. The man won't eat the dinner, but Dee loves it and really goes for the traditional foods that she's had in her home through her whole life. But then Dee, halfway through dinner, sees the butter churn in the corner, which is being used as a butter churn. And she leaps up and says, that's what I want. I knew I wanted something. And she takes the top of the butter churn and says, I'm going to make this a centerpiece on my buffet. And her mother just lets it go. She lets her have it. She doesn't fight. I mean, I don't know how she's going to churn her butter. But it was a top of a butter churn made particularly for that mother by her uncle out of the tree that stood in her uncle's front yard. And it fit her hand exactly. And she can feel it when her eyes are closed and tell where her hand fits on the top of the butter churn for churning. But her daughter claims it, and she just doesn't say anything. She lets her daughter have it. It's going to be a centerpiece on her buffet. Then at the end of the meal, the daughter gets up and goes in the bedroom and goes in the chest and takes out two quilts, handmade quilts. And they're both quilts that were made by the grandmother and the aunt for this mother. And they have every square is a memory. Every piece, you know how those quilts are. You can look at one little square and you remember that blouse or you remember that apron. And the memories that just roll through you when you look at an old quilt like that. And there was one tiny little blue square in this that was their great-great-grandfather's Civil War uniform, a piece of his uniform. And that was a treasure to her. And Dee says, I want these quilts. I'm going to take these quilts. And the mother approaches the quilts to touch them and point out a couple of things, just kind of talking about the quilts. And the daughter, Dee, won't even let her touch them. She backs off and holds them to her and says, these are my quilts now. And the mother says, why don't you take a couple of those other quilts that are in there? And the daughter says, no, they were sewed on by a machine around the edge, and I'm not going to, those aren't the best ones. These are the ones I want. And during this conversation, Maggie had been in the kitchen doing the dishes, and you hear Maggie make a loud noise, and then the kitchen door slams. So I'll pick it up there. The mother says, she's promised to give the quilts to Maggie because Maggie's going to get married to a man in the neighborhood, and she gets the quilts. And Dee says, Maggie can't appreciate these quilts. She'd probably be backward enough to put them to everyday use. Everyday use is the title of the story, and you know that that's significant because it's the title of the story. I reckon she would, I said. God knows I've been saving them for long enough with nobody using them. I hope she will. I didn't want to bring up to her how I had offered Dee, Wangaroo in parentheses, a quilt when she went away to college. Then she told me they were just old-fashioned and out of style. But they're priceless, she was saying now, furiously, for she has a temper. Maggie would put them on the bed, and in 5 years they'd be in rags. Less than that. She can always make some more, I said. Maggie knows how to quilt. Dee looked at me, Dee, parentheses, Wangaroo. It's all the way through the author plays with when she chooses to call her Dee and when she chooses to call her Wangaroo and when she chooses to include one or the other in parentheses after whatever she called her. So it's sort of fun to look at that. If you read the story, do that. She looked at me with hatred. You just will not understand. The point is, these quilts. Well, I said, stumped, what would you do with them? Hang them, she said, as if that was the only thing you could do with quilts. Maggie was now standing in the door, and Maggie says, she can have them, Mama. I can remember Grandma Dee without the quilts. I looked at her hard. She had filled her bottom lip with checkerberry snuff, and it gave her face kind of a dopey hangdog look. It was Grandma Dee and Big Dee who taught her how to quilt herself. She stood there with her scarred hands hidden in the folds of her skirt. She looked at her sister with something like fear, but she wasn't mad at her. And then when I looked at her like that, here's where the mother changes. Something hit me in the top of my head and ran down to the soles of my feet. Just like when I'm in church and the Spirit of God touches me and I get happy and shout. I did something I had never done before. I hugged Maggie to me and then dragged her on into the room, snatched the quilts out of Miss Wangaroo's hands, and dumped them into Maggie's lap. Maggie just sat there on my bed, mouth open. "Take one or two of the others," I said to Dee. But she turned without a word and went out to Hakim Barber, which was the name they'd settled on as a simpler form of his name so that the mother could say it. She said, I don't think he's a barber, but... "You just don't understand," she said, as Maggie and I came out to the car. "What don't I understand?" I wanted to know. "Your heritage," she said. And then she turned to Maggie, kissed her, and said, "You ought to try to make something of yourself, too, Maggie. It's really a new day for us. But from the way you and Mama still live, you'd never know it." She put on some sunglasses that hid everything above the tip of her nose and her chin, which is obviously putting on a cover or a front or a disguise or something. Maggie smiled, maybe at the sunglasses. But a real smile, not scared. After we watched the car dust settle, I asked Maggie to bring me a dip of snuff, and then the two of us sat there just enjoying until it was time to go into the house and go to bed. That's the end of the story. The everyday use question, of course, is the quilts, should they be everyday use or not? And the butter churn, should it be everyday use or not? And the scene where the photos are being taken, it's the daughter, Dee, is trying to claim something of her past in some way. Dee, I think, is always struggling to claim something of her past in a way that she can really make sense of, and I think taking the photos and wanting the quilts and wanting the butter churn are all stabs in that direction without success. What are your reactions? What are your thoughts about the daughters and the mother and the relationship and what happened there?